Did you bring wine?
Of course. Of course, I'm keeping this shit so consistent.
I'm not drinking alone.
No, you're not gonna drink alone. I'm about to open mine right now.
Welcome to Mind the Game with LeBron James and JJ Redick, brought to you by Uninterrupted and 342 Productions. This is episode 7, breaking down the 2024 NBA playoffs so far. A lot is discussed in this episode. This was our first remote episode. We were not in person in Los Angeles like the previous 6 episodes, but luckily it still plays really well. We recorded this on Wednesday of last week. I want to say that again. We recorded this on Wednesday of last week. A lot we get into. Playoff reflections from LeBron James. We discuss a number of topics about the Minnesota-Denver series, and it's amazing how relevant all the things we discussed are, particularly after what has transpired in the first 2 games. Just a couple actions that we discuss. One is called Spanoulis action. It is named after one of the best Greek players of all time, Vasilis Spanoulis. Of course, Spanoulis helped defeat the U.S. men's senior national team in the 2006 FIBA World Championships in the semifinals. Spanoulis action is very simple. There is a big that will catch the ball right here. There's a screener somewhere in the middle of the paint. A lot of times it will be initiated with a cut down underneath the basket. There's a rub screen. A rub screen is simply an off-ball screen that leads to a dribble handoff. We talked about this action a lot with Jamal Murray getting to his left hand. In the context of the Denver Nuggets, this is Jokic with the ball. This is Jamal Murray underneath the basket. He's cut through. This is Aaron Gordon. Aaron Gordon will set that rub screen, which is, again, just an off-ball screen that leads a lot of times to a dribble handoff, and Jamal Murray now coming to his left hand. Aaron Gordon would relocate to the dunker spot. Jamal Murray now can get to his left-hand drive, and Jokic right here in that short roll pocket area. Spanoulis action. And as a reminder, the dunker spot is this area by these hash marks on the baseline. This is where Aaron Gordon hangs out all the time. There's also a ton of discussion on Jalen Brunson and his playoff performance so far, plus how good Tyrese Maxey was in that first round series. Another action we talk about is a double drag screen. A double drag screen is simply a high double pick and roll. A lot of times this first screener is a guard. He will set a screen on Tyrese Maxey. Then the big will set a screen on Tyrese Maxey. And Maxey, with this squiggly line, can get downhill to his right hand. There's a ton of variations off double drag. We talked about this in episode 6, the Klay Thompson double drag shallow, Lauri Markkanen double drag shallow. That was with an empty side. But for the most part, double drag, 2 guys spaced to the corner, and then a double high pick and roll. One of the things we discuss at the end is the Dortcher chamber. We talk about what it's like in a playoff series getting hounded by elite defenders like Lu Dort, like Jaden McDaniels, and LeBron, of course, has faced that throughout his career. No better guy to hear from on that. As always, thank you for listening to Mind the Game. This is a little bit of a longer episode, lots of stuff to get into. If you haven't already, please hit that subscribe button. This is Mind the Game, episode 7. First time doing this where we aren't in person. It's all good. It's all good. I feel like in episode 5, we talked a little bit about the playoffs. I want to revisit some of that conversation, but I also want to talk about what has happened already and what we think might happen in this year's playoffs. Before we do that, though, I'm just curious about your emotions right now. I was thinking about it today. And I was looking back at like every single year,
the common emotions when the season ended and some unique emotions depending on which team I was on. You've obviously won a championship. I don't know what those emotions are like, but what can you just describe what the end of the season is like?
Well, look, can we cheers first before
You're right. My bad.
Can we cheers? Yeah. Cheers.
Cheers.
Shit, where am I emotionally right now? I don't know, to be honest. I have no idea where I am emotionally right now. Obviously, going against the defending champions in the first round is always going to be a difficult challenge. We knew that coming into it. But fuck, we had so many opportunities, man. You know, and to lose in five, two of them being game winners by, Jamal, his greatness. You know, but we had so many opportunities. Obviously, being up, 20, in game two, and they're building and losing that game and having so many opportunities in other games, you just feel like, shit, if one play here, one play there, could have made a hell of a difference. But, when you're playing against a team like that, you have zero room for error. And I believe we made too many errors in some of the games. Like, I mean, I've seen some crazy ass stat about like the minutes that we were leading in the series compared to losing in the series. But we both know that's a little bit of fool's gold because most playoff games come down to one or two, three or four possessions, And if you're not able to capitalize off those possessions or make plays during those possessions, then that's how you lose games. So, emotionally, I feel like we was like right there, obviously, in every game to be able to steal a game. But also at the same time, we were. And that's why we lost the series. And shit hurts, obviously. You know, being a competitor, I am. Competitor you are. You've been in multiple series in your career as well. But fuck, man, I feel like, a couple plays here, a couple plays there. We could have won the series. But the better team won. The better team won, for sure. Give credit where credit is due.
I think that's fair. I want to go back to the singular play thing in a second, but I was thinking about the come down of the season, and I was having a conversation with someone who's worked in the NBA a long time a couple weeks ago. We were talking about the stress levels of different positions within the NBA, right? Front office, coaching, players, all that. And I feel like as a player, you're always on edge during the season.
Always.
There's no like comfort level. The intensity, even just like going to dinner with friends, you're still like wired.
Thinking about the game. Yeah.
And I think when the season ends, that was always the weirdest transition. There's certainly sometimes anger. There's certainly sadness. Like that, those emotions are there, but it's like, I know this sounds fucking weird, man, but sometimes when the season would end, I would be like, okay, I need to figure out how I can re-enter society. Because I've had to be on for the last seven, eight months.
Yep, for sure. Yep, you're absolutely right, man. And, it's getting readjusted to what reality actually really is, is always difficult after the season because, like you said, you've been in such a, bubble, for 7, 8 months, whatever the case, however long the season was, that getting reacclimated to actuality, society is always a transition.
Do you approach these type of off seasons differently with USA Basketball coming up?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, it's going to be a little bit different, for me, probably over like the last 4 to 5 years, I've kind of, after the season, tried to get my body at least 2 months of like no basketball. I'm still doing, like the yogas and the Pilates and, walking around, still being active and stretching and all that type of shit. But as far as I've tried to get my body like 2 months, just I don't want to be on the basketball court at all. Actually like training. But it's challenging now because it's May 1st and in 2 months training camp actually starts in Vegas, and I don't want to go into training camp doing nothing on the court for 2 months. So I'm going to kind of switch it up a little bit. I'm not going to be, going crazy with my training, whatever the case may be. I'll probably take the month of May off, give my body an opportunity to rest,
And then probably around the first or second week of June, I'll start to kind of get back into the game a little bit, start getting some routine shots up, getting a feel for the ball. So now I got the FIBA ball I got to work with too. So that's a little different, but just getting my body reacclimated to just some of the movements that you never do in a regular day-to-day basis as far as when you're doing, workouts. So yeah, I'll switch it up a little bit.
I would always do the same thing, 6 to 8 weeks, depending on, when the season, obviously, the years I made the finals, conference finals, those two years, my break from basketball was a little bit shorter, but I've kept my body going. The thing that I realized, though, when I got older is, like, I can't turn it off, because once I turn the faucet off, the water's never coming back.
It's over.
So I became even more diligent in those, in the basketball breaks about my lifts, my Pilates, my conditioning, all the mobility stuff I was working on, physical therapy, whatever I need to work on. Like, if I actually do take time off and do nothing, I'm just gonna be done. Like, that's the reality. There were some singular plays in that Denver series for sure. And we have committed, I think, committed, and maybe we haven't been perfect, but we have committed to avoiding, or at least trying to, the discourse. I am, of course, on the other side of this, working in media, so I see everything, right? And a lot of, it's because it's you guys, honestly, a lot of it is blaming someone, blaming this player for this play, or this player for this performance. I get it, man. Like, it's part of the job. I understand that. I think what you said is important, and this is not an excuse for the Lakers. It's not. What you said is important. Denver is the better team. As an analyst, I would have told you that yesterday. I would have told you that 4 months ago. Hey, LeBron. I think Denver's a better team than you guys. Like, I would just be honest with you. You have played them 2 years in a row. We have spent some time on Jokic. He's certainly part of the puzzle, a big part of the puzzle. What makes the Denver Nuggets puzzle so hard to solve?
I think, obviously it starts with Joker, obviously. But I don't think Jamal Murray gets enough credit. He's not a part of the, all NBA conversation discourse. He's not a part of the I'm an all-star every year discourse, all that shit. And I think, people get caught up in just thinking it's just Joker, Joker, Joker. How do you stop Joker? Man, when it comes to nut crunching time, yes, Joker gonna make a lot of plays. But it's that motherfucker, Jamal Murray, that will send you home, and I'm a victim of it. And he just makes plays. He it's a sense of calmness when the ball is in his hand and they're working that side, clear side, 1-5 pick and roll, or that mid pick and roll, or that angle pick and roll, where he's either handling and Joker setting it, or he's playing a touch game to Joker where he could come off full speed. He has the ability to go back door. He's so shifty, the step backs, going right. You can't even dictate which way, how you can see, okay, this guy shoots better going this way. This guy shoots off the dribble going this way. Well, he hit two game winners on us in the series. One was a step back going right. Other one was a step back going left. So what the fuck do you do? And yes, we could have played the last one a little bit better defensively, but that's a different story. And then to add on to those two guys, Michael Porter Jr. is a fucking laser. I don't know if it's just because he sees the Lakers or the gold or whatever, but I feel like versus us, that motherfucker don't miss. He does miss.
I called the one game where he literally did not miss.
in LA. He literally did not miss. He literally did not miss. And I was like, man, you can't even get, how they say, close the gap, get to his chest. He doesn't even see you. He doesn't see you. And then those other two guys, man, you got KCP out there, a guy who's just a winner, who makes winning plays. He could have 0 points. He could have 15 points, and he's going to make an impact on a game. And the same with Aaron Gordon. Aaron Gordon, if he has 2 points or if he has 20 points, his impact doesn't change. He's going to rebound. He's going to stay. He knows his role. He's going to be in the dunker. He's going to slash from the baseline. You know, he's on guard. I just think they're super well organized as a group. And then obviously, you know, their coaching staff is pretty damn good on knowing, you know, what their strengths, and they go to their strengths. They avoid their weakness. You know, they avoid their weakness. It's not many. See, the difference between great teams, good teams, and bad teams is to how many possessions can you go throughout the course of the game that meant absolutely nothing. Meaning a great team won't go through too many games where they had terrible possessions where it was like, what the fuck are we doing? Where a great team would never throw the ball into the post to a guy and we're going to expect him to score if that's not what the fuck he do. A great team would never run a pick and roll with a player if he's not a pick and roll player. That's where the great, the good, and the bad lies. Denver, they know what their strengths are. And it's not nobody on that floor that does something that they shouldn't be doing. And I think that's what ultimately makes a great team.
Doc Rivers always talks about basketball as a game of mistakes, right? And it is. Yep. Like I get killed for saying this, but I'll stand by this. I don't think there's ever been a perfect player. I don't think there's ever been a perfect team. I don't know of a team that did not turn the ball over, did not miss a shot, did not lose a game. Like, basketball is a game of mistakes. Mm-hmm. What you just said is, I think, really important, and it gets ratcheted up more, even more in the playoffs, mm-hmm. and that is having purpose to every possession.
Yeah.
That is having an intent to what we're trying to do on this possession. I think that's an important point. I'm glad you brought up Michael Porter Jr. because he has really, to me, embraced like the role that he has. And I've talked to him about it, and some of it is the guy has had insane injuries, the back surgeries, playing with drop foot, all that stuff.
Yep.
He's just grateful to play now. But I think he is the hardest player that is not like a primary scorer, right? He's the hardest player to close out to.
Yeah.
The reason I say that, he's 6'10".
Correct.
He elevates on his jump shot. They always maintain elite spacing. So if you make a mistake in your help or you make a mistake on the Jamal Murray, Nikola Jokic coverage in a pick and roll, and you have to react to that, you have to overhelp, you get beat by Jamal Murray, ball starts swinging, you can't close to him. He just is going to shoot over the top. Mm-hmm. And if for some reason you are there soon enough, he's gotten elite at driving closeouts.
Correct.
He really has. Whether he's getting to his midi or he's getting all the way to the basket.
Yep.
Like, he's not a primary guy, but he's a star in his role. And as we see all the time in the playoffs, those guys become even more important in a series. Because whole point of the playoffs, LeBron, you know, the whole point of the playoffs is like, how do we make every single player uncomfortable? And it starts with the star players. How do we make the star players uncomfortable?
Mm-hmm. Yep. I mean, listen, Jamal hit two game winners on us, but you look at his numbers, we did a hell of a job on Jamal as far as making it tough on him. He shot maybe high 30s, maybe. I don't know the statistics, but maybe high 30s from the field in our series. And obviously, Joker's going to do what he did. Michael Porter is the one who kicked our ass. You know, he kicked our ass. And you remember we was talking about, like, having luck to win a championship? Mm-hmm. Denver is a case for that. There's no way coming out of high school before the back surgery that Michael Porter would even be in Denver. This guy was a projected number one pick in the draft, you know? And because of the back, you know, teams get alarmed and whatever the case may be because of that. And he slid in the draft, and he slid right to the perfect position and perfect spot. They waited on him, didn't rush him, whatever the case may be. Then he got in, and then he was still a little injured, like you said, with the drop foot or whatever the case may be. But now he's in a perfect situation. He's in a perfect situation around two guys that you have to keep not only your eyes on him if you're guarding as a primary defender, but then another set of eyes. So it's going to be somebody on that floor that you're going to forget about. You know, he makes you pay. Like you said, 6'10". He shoots at the top of his jump shot. His elbow was right in your face too, so you can't close the gap, because if you hit his elbow, there's three free throws. And he's a big time player.
I'm gonna draw while I'm talking here. But we've talked about the singular plays and the luck.
Mm-hmm.
I want to talk about fouling up three, whether or not to foul up three, because we've seen this happen already. Multiple times, sometimes yep. multiple times within a game, yep. sometimes multiple times within a series.
Yep.
I don't know how every coach you've had has approached whether or not to foul up three at the end of a game on a defensive possession. But just kind of give me your overall thoughts on it. And I really do want to sort of break this down, because I think it's going to come up again. It's going to come up again.
Yeah, and what are all the circumstances that's going on at this point? Okay, so you're up three. Is it under 24 seconds left in the game? Is it, do we have a timeout? What are some of the cases? I was watching the game last night. Obviously, New York up three. Tyrese had just hit a four-point play. They come back down. Josh Hart goes 1-for-2 from the free throw line, put him up three. Philly's coming down, and I would have fouled. I would have. I would have fouled before Tyrese even crossed half court.
Okay.
I just do it. And it has to be on the downward dribble. If you're going to foul, you have to foul on the downward dribble. And it's hard. And sometimes a lot of guys are afraid to do it too. A lot of coaches are afraid to tell their team to foul one up three because either one, they haven't worked on it, or two, it is, with our rules and things, it gets tricky sometimes. And you send a guy to the free throw line, because you tried to foul him in a case. But I am fouling. I am fouling. I am fouling. I am fouling. It's just, guys are too great, man. Guys are too great.
I'm in agreement with you. I'm fouling up three every single time.
Every single time.
Every single time. Look, I think though, to your point, about fouling Maxi on that particular play in the backcourt, I don't have it off the top of my head when he caught the ball.
Right.
But let's say when he's in the backcourt, he's somewhere between 10 and 12 seconds on the clock.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of coaches that I had that taught us to foul up three, it was always, you don't consider doing it until it's 6 to 8 seconds.
Like 6 to 8 seconds, exactly.
Right, which I don't really know why we did that cutoff. Maybe we can get into that. So the foul on the Maxi play would have been early. The other two factors that you always have to consider do you have good free throw shooters? Do you have a good guy, like a guy you trust? You have multiple guys you can trust. Like when I played on the Clippers, man, like our end game offensive closing lineup was me, Jamal Crawford, and Chris Paul. There was one year we all shot 90%.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So we should foul up three. Mm-hmm. You talked about the downward dribble. This is what I wanted to drop because this relates directly to the play that happened, the first Middleton three in game three of Indy and Milwaukee.
Yep. So
Middleton had it out of bounds, right? Brooke had it posting up Miles Turner right here, right?
Yep.
So Brooke's trying to get open, and he kind of shoves Miles Turner, and he steps out. Now, this was a lob pass.
Yep.
So this is an important thing that I think was taught well to me, and I think is important in all of this. Full court and half court are two different things. As that ball's in the air, so Brooks right there,
mm-hmm.
like I was taught to run through the ball.
Run through the ball.
Meaning just foul before the guy gets it.
Yep.
The
ball's been released, yep.
The ball's been released. So in that particular play, they obviously were not fouling up three. He then gets the dribble handoff up here,
mm-hmm.
Miles Turner hedges.
Hedges,
and forces like a dribble around, right, away from the basket. So he had like two or three opportunities to foul.
To foul.
Clearly, yeah. Rick Carlisle's telling him not to foul, right? And Middleton makes a crazy shot. All of this is to say, and you said it already, these guys are too fucking good. Middleton's shot was ridiculous. Maxey pulled up from 37 feet or 38, whatever it was, 38 feet inside the logo. Like, you can't afford to allow guys to get a clean shot anymore. If you go back to game two as well, I think it was game two, the Dante DiVincenzo, you know, Maxey getting fouled and losing the ball and all that stuff. DiVincenzo hits a three. They end up getting it back. They were up three again, and they elected not to foul. I think there were 6 seconds on the clock when they took it out. So clearly Tibbs, whether he made the adjustment or not, like, certain coaches still believe you don't foul, and I think there's the camp that you foul every time.
Yeah, I just, and you have to live with it. It's almost like if you're a blackjack player, if you're going to hit every time on a versus two on 12, then do it every time. If it's a two showing and you got 12, if you hit all the time, just hit all the time. Don't be sitting at the table with me and you say, well, sometimes I hit it, sometimes I don't. Well, no, I can't sit at this table with you. So I agree. We have coaches out there that say, we're going to guard. I trust my defense. We're going to guard. I'm just not on that side. I'm on the side of, if we up three, let's foul. Let's foul up three. You know, you got to trust it. Hopefully, you know, got to, obviously, like you said, personnel is key. You got to have a trusted guy that you trust to inbound the ball. After they make free throws, you know, if you have a timeout, you should be good. Try to get the ball into your best free throw shooter. If not, call a timeout, advance it. If you don't have a timeout, get it to your best free throw shooter. But these are things you work on in practice. Hey, if we up three, no timeouts, we're going to foul. If they make two, you take the ball out, expect a trap on the first one. Expect a trap, because they're going to try to trap you and get the ball, boom, boom, boom. You do all that stuff. So, like, it's all about preparation, man. It's about preparation. And like I said, I'm with you, JJ, when it comes to being up three. I want to foul. I don't like seeing that ball up in the air while we're watching the ball, like, oh shit, this is going in. This shit is going in.
The feeling of victory was so fucking close. Now we got to go to overtime.
So close.
The timeout thing is also important, I think, in all of this, where if a team's out of timeouts,
yeah.
Number one, if it's under 10 seconds, it should be automatic. But they're out of timeouts, let's say with 20 seconds. I think there's more wiggle room to fouling earlier. In this case, the Maxey play. Singular plays, fouling up three, brings up a memory, LeBron, 2009, we're down 2-1. We're up 12 at halftime against the Lakers in game four. We play our ass off, have some turnover issues, have some free throw issues. We're still up five with under a minute to go and the ball to tie the series. Some things happen. We miss some free throws. Kobe makes a ridiculous pass to Powell, who cuts down the lane and dunks it. 87-84. We go back to the free throw line. Anyways, it ends up, they get the ball back with about 10 seconds to go in front of their bench. For some reason, I don't know why, we doubled Kobe. He swung it to Trevor Ariza, who threw it across the court to Derek Fisher.
To Fish.
And he just lined up a three.
He just lined it up.
Do you remember, I was trying to figure out today on Basketball Reference and I couldn't find it. Do you remember what year it was we were playing, I think it was in Cleveland, and Stan had just sort of implemented, we're going to foul up three. And I think it was that year, it might have been the year before, and we're playing against you guys, and you catch the ball right near half court, like not shooting range, and there's still time on the clock, and you read it right, and we fouled, and you went in your shooting motion, and you got the three free throws. I'm trying to figure out, like, did that have something? Because we didn't say, as far as I can remember, and clearly by Cheers' defensive approach, we didn't say we're going to foul. Right? Fuck, man. I'm not saying we would have won the series, by the way. I'm not saying that.
I mean, but listen, 2-2 is a hell of a lot better than 3-1. I know.
Speaking of Jamal Murray, Brunson, Maxey, these guys.
Yeah, man.
One thing that I love about all three of them, so they are considered point guards now, right? so many times will just get off the ball,
yep,
cut down, and then get, let's say this is Jamal because he does like to come to his left hand. They'll just get this little rub screen into a DHO, right? That action to me is so, like, practicing that action, doing it in games all season long, stuff like that, I think becomes even more valuable in the playoffs because you can't set the defense.
You can't set the defense, and you're getting off the ball, and we all know that once a primary guy gets off the ball, what the defender does, just for one split second, he relaxes a little bit. So, you know, when Maul and Reese and Jalen, they're getting off the ball, you relax just a little bit, and I'm flying underneath, and I'm getting a screen. You know, in our case, it's Aaron Gordon setting the screen, so you kind of want to stay body on body. You don't want to switch that because now Aaron Gordon is going to duck in a smaller guy into the paint. You don't want to switch that. You know, with Tyrese, you know, his, you know, they swinging it to Embiid, you know, and when he's handing a handoff, the guy that's guarding Embiid is so focused on Embiid maybe going one-on-one, when the drop-off happens, he's not in a position to help. So Tyrese is coming off naked. He's coming off getting to his 1-2-3, going left, step back. You know, he's coming off with so much force and so much speed, and those three guys, they come off with so much speed and they keep your defense honored all the time. There's no false gas with them when they're in action.
The play with Maxi that I just think is so hard is their simple double drag.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll, a lot of times in this series at least, and again, we don't know the outcome of the series, but a lot of times in this series, they've used Jalen Brunson's man as the first screener. Whoever Jalen is guarding, right? He's the first screener in here.
Because they don't want him to switch it.
Right, exactly. And it just feels like with Maxi, you bring up the speed, mm-hmm, with Maxi in particular, the way right, he's able to turn this corner,
mm-hmm,
and then have this defender still so concerned with Joel,
yep,
this to me is one of the toughest actions to guard, mm-hmm, for the Philadelphia 76ers. No, it's a simple play. Right. It's just a double drag.
It is,
but it creates an advantage because of his speed and because, yep, Joel is there.
Yep, and that creates the whole ripple effect. That's what the offense is all dictated on. How can I create a trigger? Who can create a trigger on the floor to make this whole thing work? And like you're saying, with Reese coming at that, and they don't just do like a double drag where it's like guys are like stacked right behind each other. They spread it out a little bit. So you have the first screener here, and then they angle it a little bit, and then the next screener is kind of in the middle of the floor, they angle it a little bit. So when Tyrese is coming off, he's already running downhill. And because of his three-point shooting, all three
this
of
is
them
what you mean
much,
by the angle, right?
Yep,
the first
exactly,
screener's a little bit,
yep,
higher, they're spaced
a little
out
bit higher.
The second,
yep,
screener's a little bit lower.
Exactly.
And of course, as we've seen with Maxi, by the way, you go under, he shoots.
You go
under,
he shoots it from there. Exactly. And the same with those other two guys, with Brunson and with Jamal, they will stop and pop. So, you know, when you have a threat at that point guard position with that type of speed, the offense will work. That's the trigger. That's the trigger right there.
Specifically with Brunson, where do you think some of the adjustments have been in this series offensively for them to get him more space?
They got him off the ball a little bit more. You know, obviously he always ends up with the ball, but I think early in the clock they've gotten him off the ball and then allow him to get the ball after that. You know, I've seen, Dante bring the ball up a little bit more. You know, Josh Hart can bring the ball up a lot more too, because he's not much of he shoots the three, but he's not much of a threat out there when he's handling the ball. So his defender is going to play off him a little bit. So it allows him to be able to go to, you know, DHOs, dribble handoffs to Brunson with a live dribble. It allows him to hit, you know, either Hardenstein, or Mitchell Robinson. You know, they play that kind of like that touch game, and then they go set a pin down for Brunson coming to his left. So I think they've gotten Jalen Brunson off the ball a little bit more and allowed him to now get into his wiggle room. He's being guarded by bigger guys. I mean, Nicholas Batum is guarding him. Kelly Oubre is guarding him. Tobias Harris is guarding him. They're trying to put some length, you know, around him, you know, to try to contain him a little bit. But shit, he's still getting off because he's so crafty.
Yeah, that's a big part of it to me, is having someone else just bring the ball up.
Yeah.
You think about those first couple games, and it's not that he's not, he didn't do it in games 3, 4, or 5.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
You think about those first two couple games where he's initiating the offense every time. Kelly Oubre is picking him up at 94
feet. Yeah. Yeah.
Every single possession, every single dead ball, every single make, he's guarding him. And that, to me, takes a little bit of a toll, particularly for a guy who does legitimately nearly all of the half-court creation for that team.
Yeah,
right?
For sure.
With no Julius Randle.
With no
the
Julius
other
Randle,
thing,
yeah.
The other thing that they've done, I think, is this angle pick and roll up here.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times it is an empty side, by the way. This angle pick and roll up here, they've done a good job, I think, of keeping it off the sideline. And why is that important? So if Joel's in a drop, we saw this in game 5. Joel's in a drop. They're going to force him to his right hand, right? Jalen can shoot that pull-up 3. But the other reason it's important is whether Joel is up or back, as Jalen comes off this pick right here, he now has space.
Yep.
This is like a big thing, I think. Yep. And it's going to be a big thing with Minnesota and Denver as well with Anthony Edwards pick and roll.
Yep.
You want these guys. Like Damian Lillard to me is I think the best at doing this, particularly going left. You want these guys to have space. So let's say Joel's all the way up. You want space to be able to get around him. You don't want it too close to the sideline.
Yep.
Right? Third defender. Let's say he's back. They do a good job of chasing over. Now Jalen, as we saw multiple times this series, can get past him either way, right? With his footwork speed, got an and one, all that stuff. So I think the way it's not just like, oh, we're gonna run an angle pick and roll. It's where you're putting everyone else, and it's where it is on the floor. It's giving enough space for them to actually attack the big.
Yep, absolutely. And obviously you go through the game from game to game, you see how they're being guarded, you know, and in your case, you know, Jalen Brunson having that room on the sideline, he either can race the big, like you said, going, you know, north and south, race the big to the, you saw it last night a couple of times, he raced Joel, got a layup. He also has the ability coming right. If Joel's in a drop, he has the ability to snake it going back left to where he's super comfortable with his mid-range, getting back to his left, using his footwork. And also, you know, if you get it going early, like you said, Dame Lillard is the best at this. If that big is too far, once that offensive five sets that screen, Dame's coming off and he's letting it go. That ball is gone before that big can't get up fast enough.
Yeah.
He's letting it go. And Dame and Steph are two of the guys in our league. Their bigs will screen them, Draymond and now Brooke and those guys. They come and screen off their guys at half court. As soon as they cross half court, they're in range.
I was thinking about Maxey. He's sort of the third guy I brought up, and I was thinking about him today. And I was thinking about the playoffs, right? And Joel is a big piece in this because I think having him on the floor, we watched Maxey play. Maxey was great with no Joel this season, but he's clearly a better player with Joel, right? Yeah. And I was thinking about Maxey. And like, yes, he's fast, but he also changes speeds so well. The way I would describe him and why I think he's so good in the playoffs is because you can't get a hold of him. Do you know what I mean by that?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's like he constantly plays with a bounce to his step. And sometimes the bounces are slower, sometimes they're faster. And then when he wants to turn on the jets, he turns on the jets. But it's hard with just two defenders, I think, and space to actually get a hold of him, put your hands on him and really slow him down.
Yeah, and the motherfucker don't get tired.
Mm. Yeah.
He don't get tired. I mean, I watched that game last night. What? I think he played 50 minutes, I think, maybe. You know, hurt his elbow at one point, turned his ankle at one point, hit the ground numerous of times, tried to go in the lane and dunk on two guys, get it blocked, get back up. But he's, like you said, you can't get a hold of him because he don't get tired.
He just don't get tired.
He don't get tired.
That's a great point. So the reason I bring up that Anthony Edwards Jokic stuff, because to me this is like probably will be the most fascinating second round series.
Yeah, it's going to be a good one.
It's going to be a good one. where do you think, we were talking earlier about solving the Denver Nuggets puzzle, but where do you think Minnesota has an advantage or can create an advantage?
I think one of, obviously, Minnesota's advantage, which they have in our league in general, no matter if it's versus Denver or versus anybody, is the length that they have at the wing positions. You don't look at Mike Conley as a tall guy, but his length, you know, he has a lot of length out there. Obviously, Ant Edwards, a lot of length. Jaden McDaniels, length. Cat, length. Rudy, length. You know, they come off with Nickeil Alexander-Walker, length. Naz Reid, length. Kyle Anderson. They continue to barrage you with length, and then guys that also know how to play too. So, you know, that's been their biggest advantage because they've bought in to Coach Finch defensive schemes or whoever their defensive coordinator is there. I don't want to speculate, whatever the case may be, but he's the guy at the helm.
The coaching staff.
Yeah, the coaching staff.
The
coaching staff. And those guys have bought into the defensive end. And it's not only that they bought into the defensive end, they got guys that want to defend, you know, and make their mark on the defensive end. So that creates havoc for any team, you know, not just, Phoenix and not just for Denver. I think they, you know, Denver's the, you're going to have the best offensive team that we have in the game, excluding Boston, versus the best defensive team that we have in our league right now. You know, going at it in a second round matchup, which is super intriguing and exciting for guys like myself and fans of the game.
Yeah. A couple things. So the reason I bring up the Anthony Edwards thing, so Jokic likes to be up in the pick and roll, right? So yep. in let's say the same scenario where Anthony Edwards is getting this angle pick and roll, Jokic is going to be all the way up as he comes off.
Yeah.
So the space and where they set this screen, mm-hmm. who the next guy is over here,
mm-hmm.
where they space Gobert, all of this stuff, super important. If it is Karl-Anthony Towns setting the screen, Naz Reid, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do they get to a pre-switch? Does Anthony Edwards run a pick and roll versus whoever Jamal Murray's guarding, right? Get him on him. Then all of a sudden you've got Karl-Anthony Towns, Naz Reid against Jamal Murray if they switch. The other thing they did a ton in the Phoenix series, you know, when Ant was in ISO, you've got Kat as the next guy.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean by that? Being the next guy? Of course you do.
Yeah.
Let me explain the next guy. All right, so I'm going to use O's for offense now. I fucking keep doing this. So let's say Ant has a matchup, or he's going against whoever. He's going against KCP. The next guy, meaning Karl-Anthony Towns, is the next pass. So as he drives, he tries to create whatever it may be, that next pass is to Karl-Anthony Towns. That's important. These are things that, like, to your point earlier, I think I just want to reiterate this. There's a purpose to every possession.
Yeah.
There's a reason that Aaron Gordon is spaced this way. There is a reason that Jaden McDaniels is spaced in the corner. Like, there's a reason behind all of this.
Yeah, and I think if Minnesota decides to put Joker in pick and rolls a lot, I think they're going to trap him. They're going to force Rudy to be a decision maker in the pocket. That's what I would do. I mean, because it's a different beast from, you know, Anthony Davis catching in the pocket, you know, to Rudy catching in the pocket. And yes, he can make plays. We know that. I mean, he's an NBA player. And it's not like the first time teams have blitzed off of him. But, you know, when you allow Ant to get downhill or you allow him to turn a corner, it just opens up too much for that Minnesota team. So, you know, we'll see. We'll see. I mean, it's all speculation and just us using our basketball IQ and our smarts of the game. But I think, you know,
I don't think we're giving away any secrets, though. I think we're trying to break down, like, essentially what is going through a coaching staff, what is going through a player's head in mm-hmm. the playoffs. These are the things that all teams meet this way. This is how how do we exploit this specific team? How do we exploit this specific matchup?
Exactly.
And in some cases, because I lived through it, how do I avoid this matchup?
You know? Yeah, exactly. So, you know, that's what's going to happen. You know, you got two great teams going at it, two of the best teams this year. And the it's going to be a chess. It's going to be a chess game of going into game one. Okay, this is our game plan. All right, shit. Going into game two. Okay, that worked in game one. Okay, well, maybe it didn't work as much as we thought we did. Let's make a change.
The one seed in the West, the team that was too young, was Oklahoma City. They swept the Pelicans. Obviously, Pelicans without their best player.
Yeah.
Number of guys played well in that series. Shea, of course, had some big moments. Jalen Williams had some massive games. But the guy that really stood out to me, particularly because there was no Zion, was Lu Dort.
Mm-hmm.
His defense on Brandon Ingram.
Yeah, for sure. Yep.
I wanted to ask you, as a primary guy, what does it feel like going into a series, knowing that you are going against a Lu Dort that's just going to be in your shirt? He's not going to concede switches, right? Yep. You may force him into a switch at times, but he's never going to concede the switch. Like, he knows what his role is. And then as the series progresses and you've now become annoyed with him by minute 40 of game one and it's now game four. I'm serious, dude. The process for you, for any great offensive player, Luka right now going through it with Terrence Mann, like, what is that like?
I think anytime you go into a series with a defender that's capable of Lu Dort's skills, you can't have much fat on the court. And that's fuck around time. I'm not coming out here trying to get in my bag. I'm not trying to come out here, you know, doing between behinds, crossovers to get you off of me. If I'm in a pick and roll, you tell your big, you got to screen him. Yes, he's going to try to fight through it, but I need you to screen him. Get him up off of me for a little bit. And then if I'm in ISO situations, I know I can't fuck around. It's quick moves, one counter, and get to my spot, either all the way to the cup or get to my spot on the floor. Because if you play around with guys like that, they're gonna wear on you. They're going to keep their body on you. They're going to make it physical. You know, in the playoffs, you're allowed to be a little bit more physical. Well, as I've seen in all the other series, in our series, it felt like a fucking regular season game. But whatever, that's beside the point.
Says the guy whose team had the greatest free throw disparity in the NBA the last two seasons. This fucking guy.
Fuck that. So you gotta just go. There's no, maybe you can get one game to wear up to warm up to it, warm up to his intensity, the way he's playing, whatever. But it's not much. You can't be out there fucking around with your movements and you getting the job done, because he's not going for none of that. He's there in your chest.
Is that mindset around not messing around? Is that because you know there's going to be a toll with him guarding you, so doing extra creates an extra toll? Is that sort of the mindset of that?
Yeah, absolutely. And also at the same time, you know, I believe you can wear guys like that down as well. You know, if you're not messing around, you may be able to get him with an early cheap one, you know, because he's trying to be too physical. You know, so you go quick and you get a quick early cheap one on him. So now he got one foul with 10 minutes to go in the first. He gonna back off a little bit. You know, you able to get him a second foul, you know, late in the first quarter, early in the second, maybe. He damn sure went on pick up three in the first half, because now he got to come out for the rest of the half. So, you know, for me, it's, you know, I'll try to just play the chess game for sure. But, you know, Dort was definitely doing his thing versus B.I. and the rest of those guys. He had him, in wrestling terms, he had him in the Cobra clutch.
Is there anyone that you'd like to praise? Any of those defenders like Lu Dort that you feel like throughout your career, whether you've won or lost, or whether they've lost or won, where you just, you would get done with the series and be like, oh, dude, that guy has my respect.
You know, I think it was my first year back in Cleveland on a return, and it was maybe our first round opponent. I think we played Detroit, if I'm not mistaken. And I think KCP was on that team. Drummond was on that team. A couple other guys was on that team. Obviously, Moose was on that team, I believe. I think Stan was coaching, if I'm not mistaken. I think Stan was coaching that team. But back to your question, Stanley Johnson was, he earned my respect in that first round series. Stanley Johnson, he had the lateral movement. He had the physicality. You could tell that the coaching staff told him, don't worry about the schemes. I feel like the same thing with Dort. It was like, don't worry about the schemes. Yeah, everybody's switching but you. You get through every screen. If you weak side low man, you have no responsibility. You don't pull in. You're basically playing a boxing one. You know, there's a lot more guys, obviously, I would give credit to defensively, but that's the one guy I like off the top of my head.
I know exactly what you're saying.
It's not recent memory. It's 10 years ago, but it's recent enough. But Stanley definitely was, he possessed those skills in our league for sure.
Well, this has been fun. The last point I want to make, because I like when one show builds upon another. You know, we did the show last week about three-point shooting mm-hmm. and why it's sort of changed everything. I saw a great stat today that came across my timeline. teams that make more threes in this playoffs, so far 27-9. Teams that attempt more threes, just attempt more threes, are 27-8. There's a lot of there's a lot of factors in all of this, right? Because some of these games are coming down to single plays. You can have a high turnover game with a bunch of live ball turnovers, like the Clippers did in game three, that leads to a bunch of fast break points for the mat. Like, there's a bunch of factors to a game.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there's other stats that show, if you do this versus this, right, you're going to win the game. All I'm saying is, I think three-point shooting's pretty important. I think there's a math issue.
But where do you stand as far as more threes, more for when you're coaching your son's team, is it more threes?
My son's team.
Is it more threes or less threes when you're coaching your son's team on a weekend? What is it?
I believe math should play into it. I think there's times now where you have to play a perfect game if at the baseline level you're going to be outmathed.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
do you know what I mean? You have to say, okay, where can we create an advantage? Can we be a team that forces a ton of turnovers?
Right.
Can we be a team that crashes the offensive glass? There's other ways to create advantages. My point is, if you're going against a team that is going to shoot 40 to 45 threes and you're going to shoot 25 to 30, you better fucking nail all of your advantages.
Right.
Otherwise, you're not going to win. It's based on math.
The math ain't mathing at that point.
Yeah. Now you got to have I recognize you got to have the personnel to do all these things. I have three kids that can shoot threes, for a 9-10 year old that are, I would call it efficient. And I tell them, I'm like, if you guys take 10 good threes in a game, 12 good threes in a game, I'm cool with it. Because these games, a high scoring game's 40 to 38, right? We got 14 minute running clocks, except for the last three minutes of the half. So it's like, if we can shoot 30 threes, and make 5 or 6 of them, I'm living with that, bro.
Yeah.
By the way, shooting a three at that age, you know what that is? That's a shot and not a turnover. So I'll take that all day.
For sure. And you know what? And in our league, too, you got to look at it that way sometimes, too. Because you got guys who get into the lane or teams get into the lane and they had a wide open three. They're trying to get into the lane, make plays, and here goes a turnover. And it's just too hard with the speed and the guys that we have in our league to get back in transition. You can't get the numbers as bad, So I'm warming up more and more as I wind my career down on the three-point attempt. But I am a math guy.
Yeah.
That was my favorite subject in school. So I definitely get it. I understand it.
You kind of alluded to this, the conversation around LeBron shooting 12, 14 threes in a game was interesting because you attacking the basket is actually
what makes like an offense work, right? So you could individually say, you know what? A lot of guys are like this. Luka could. James could. I'm going to shoot 15 threes tonight. I'm going to shoot 20 threes, right? Is that the best way for the team to run an offense? Now, in some cases, in James and Houston, it was, right?
Yeah.
Steph running around, running pick and roll, getting dribble handoffs, shooting transit. For them, that's the best way for them to run offense, taking 15 threes. So mm-hmm. I do think it's case by case. If you're in your – you're somehow still in your prime, it seems like. But if you're in your prime, you trying to get to the basket makes the game easier and open for everybody.
I mean, you know, it's pretty cool, I mean, to hear. Listen, if I have a guy that, you know, from a perimeter standpoint, as an attacker, and I know he can, you know, feast off opening our offense up by getting into the lane and making plays with the lane, you know, I could see myself, you know,
playing another maybe 6 years, just being a spot up shooter.
maybe shooting 8 to 10 threes a game. I did okay this year from the 3-point line. I did okay.
I think you should just do a complete heel turn next year, and I'm gonna send you all my tapes. I'll send you all my highlight videos, and you should just become like an off ball movement catch and shoot guy. Just flying off screens, leaning, you know, falling away.
Oh my God, you know how mad guys would be at my opponent. Like, what the fuck are you doing? Why are you running this fast coming off pin downs like this?
All right, man. Cheers. Fun as always.
Cheers. Always fun, brother.
Hey, guys. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching Mind the Game podcast. If you like it, please hit that subscribe button. Thank you.